Who we got?
Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi.
Sorry, I'm here.
Alex.
Hello.
Oh, that's Alex.
Hey.
Yes. Hey, Alex.
So many voices right now. Has this been going on for a while, or am I late?
Right now.
No, you're.
Here it is.
Just started.
Perfect. My timing is impeccable. I thought I was late.
Yeah, this is always record number 185.
Oh, really? Okay.
This isn't
always record. Duh.
This isn't always record. We're always recording. Right.
Well, I'm talking to 42 minutes. I'm talking to Douglas Bowles here.
Well, I don't have to ask questions because this is in 42 minutes. It's just a conversation.
All right. Awesome.
But I want to know, has anyone read the book?
I have.
Yeah. It's been a while, not recently. But I did.
Yeah, not recently, but I have, yeah.
It's a great book.
Alex, have you seen the 97 remake?
No, I have not. With Jeremy Irons.
Yeah.
How faithful is the Kubrick movie to the book?
It's pretty darn faithful. I mean, Nabokov wrote the screenplay, so.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so it's kind of crazy. Kubrick and Nabokov kind of actually work together on the screenplay, and it's really faithful. I think it's one of the most faithful book, not maybe necessarily in terms of detail, although I think it is.
Is
but,
the book
just
more
in terms
explicit?
Of capturing the spirit? Yes, it is.
I mean, so the movie was definitely kind of wink, wink. It wasn't super explicit that he was having sex with her, but I think
things happen outside of the frame.
Yeah,
and it is still. I mean, in the book, it's not like he's, you know, having sex with her all the time. It's a big, it's weird relationship of he's aroused by her spirit and her. This whole weird thing. It's not exactly that they're just having sex all the time.
Does it imply? So it.
I mean, it does.
Does do they really have sex in the book?
Yes, I think honestly, I can't remember. I know that they. There is sexual contact, if not full on intercourse. Yeah.
They're always saying in the movie, do they know about us, etc., like talking about the neighbors and the rest of the family or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it implies that they're together in some strange way.
I just looked it up, and yes, they do have sex.
And the structure of Lolita, the movie, is very similar to the structure of Ada, in a sense that it wraps around there, you know, like it begins in the end and then, you know, goes back to the beginning.
One thing that the I don't know if the movie really gets into is how Lolita is really a recreation or reproduction of his first love as a child.
The remake starts with that, Alex.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they don't really get into that in the Kubrick.
Yeah.
Is Lolita younger in the book as well?
Well, that's a matter of debate. She in the book she's described as being like 12 and a half, almost 13, I think. And apparently that's about the age Sue Lyon was when they were filming it, so.
Oh, really? Okay.
She was 16 when the film came out. Sue Lyon was 16. So, you know, depending on how much time we give for production versus the release date, I mean, she could be anywhere from around 14 if you have a 2-year time frame.
I don't know enough about interviews saying that she was about 14, maybe. And maybe it's 13 and a half or 12. I don't know. There's a little bit. She definitely looks older than you would kind of imagine her in the book. But.
In the Jeremy Irons remake, he talks about a when he was 14, he has this event that stilted his sexual life.
It's interesting how the girls get older. So as the paradigm changes, I mean, so definitely Nabokov latches onto this 12 years old, and I've heard that age is, for whatever reason, it seems like that is an age that's highlighted. But Laura Palmer was 17, and then Mark Frost made her 18 in the most recent version of the book, just to make it less creepy.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, weird.
That's the creepiness is the whole point.
Right. Yeah. It's like we're talking.
It is kind of a big difference. I mean, 12 and 16, I think, in terms of the creep level, you know, or even 14. I mean, we're getting into kind of uncomfortable territory here, I think. You know, but I think it's a real serious point for how this works as a film and as a narrative, is that you're playing on the viewer's kind of identification with Humbert, let's say, particularly the male viewer, because that's one of the things that I found about the film, is that he's set up as a protagonist in this movie, and like he gets his heart broken, and I was kind of there as the viewer, almost, you know, sad for him, and the other adults in the film are like clearly villainous in a way. You know, they're more sociopathic in a way than Humbert is, because he's got this kind of childish love that I think we've all fallen in love. Or let me put it this way, many, many males, cis, heterosexual males, have the experience of falling in love with like a 14, 15, 16-year-old girl. And even in that time, you know, you've got rock song, she was just 16, or the sweet 16. I mean, there's this whole kind of fetishization of this women around this age that's culturally accepted.
Well, that's, you know, the strange thing to me is that 12 is much different than 16. And so 12 is like prepubescent. Or like on the cusp of puberty, whereas 13 to 16, I mean, so that's pubescent. I mean, it's all creepy.
Well, and Claire Quilty has supposedly, you know, done things well before Humbert. Like, it's implied, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh,
sure, he's ringleader.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like a predator, basically, it sounds like.
Yeah.
How old is Ada?
Even in the
Is Ada
12? She starts 12 and 4, but they were 12 and 14, and so
that's a big difference too.
It's more palatable because they're kids.
She's described as very very mature, right? Like there's that part too, right? Like which is strange, like the whole nymphet idea.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's
definitely got, he's got some kind of hang up for sure.
in the remake, Humbert uses the word nymphet to describe her.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
He does in the Kubrick movie too. Like, he's writing about nymphets.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Diary.
Yeah. I couldn't remember.
I was reading this, something about Nabokov, and he said that he hates the character Humbert, and he hates the character of Von Veen. You know, like, it's not, people say that's Nabokov, but it's actually like, maybe it's like a shadow aspect of himself.
The whole thing is a pretty huge indictment of Humbert and the entire aesthetic, like, philosophy that he seems to operate under.
Yeah, like, definitely. He's so terrible in a way. Like, he's such a terrible person.
Exactly, and I think for me, the Shelley Duvall's character and her whole performance is just magnificent in the movie. And she's like the most sympathetic and sad character.
Shelley Winters.
Shelley Winters, yeah.
Shelley Duvall would be much better.
Did I say Duvall?
That's a different Kubrick film,
did.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, I got them. I'm sorry, they're getting
all
mixed up in
man.
My head.
We know you,
but there's a reason for them both being named Shelley, I'm sure. It's Shelley Winters, yeah. And her character is just so sad. And he just takes her advantage of her so completely.
Yeah, that scene where he's laughing after he receives her love letter, you know, that's pretty mm-hmm. heartbreaking too. You want to strangle him at that point.
But he still was so taken with Lolita that he was willing to marry this cow. Like, I mean, he said such horrible things in the diary about her. It's a pretty strange film. I've never seen it. This was my first.
Yeah.
My only frame of reference, it felt more like a 50s film. You know, there was a touch of Hitchcock to it, but mm-hmm. the dissolves and things, it definitely...
The driving.
Yeah. It felt like a Days of Yore type film, but it definitely like that 60s flavor was there. And then I almost wondered if, on some strange level, like the Peter Sellers character kind of seemed like there was like Kubrickian touches to him. Like he's walking around.
Sure, he was actually doing a Kubrick impression on one of his little disguises. I think it's the police. Mm. At the police convention was explicitly an impression of Kubrick.
Oh, really?
You can take that for what. So it's interesting. The whole Peter Sellers Kubrick connection is something you could talk about a lot. And then the film being there, which I recently watched, is important there. That whole opening scene with is really remarkable with him, Quilty, in the mansion. And it's like the Eyes Wide Shut mansion. But it's also like this out of time. Time is mixed up. There's all these references to Rome.
He mentioned Spartacus, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
right at
and he end. Has basically a toga on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's
that was
it's,
my first. Just to say, I emailed Dennis and Alex and I said, this is the Eyes Wide Shut mansion. I noticed in particular the art was kind of mm-hmm. like European style Renaissance mm-hmm. portraits. It's similar to that art, the art, I think, in that Eyes Wide Shut mansion. There's the set pieces of, you know, art that's clearly from a different cultural strata, you know, economic strata.
It also reminds me of the Venus Villas.
It reminded me of Citizen Kane,
at the later
though.
Stages when it's all... that too.
Zanor, will you explain the Venus Villas to SJ and Alex, who might not know what that...
I heard your raw audio, so thanks
for
sending
that. Oh,
you did?
Okay. Oh,
yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
I still don't have a full understanding of it, but I remember the reference and yeah. Seemed like a Eden. Was this the place, Nor, you were talking about, like a Garden in Eden type of environment? Or...
No, it's more like a horror house.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, no, I remember. Okay, yeah.
Really high-end.
Yeah, it's actually Villa Venus, I guess. It's like this guy set up this whole network across Europe of these really high-end brothels, basically. And the description of them in the book sounds exactly like the mansion in Eyes Wide Shut. And the actual scene sounds like what happened. It's almost like Kubrick copied it from Ada to that extent.
Isn't it funny that the Jeff Epstein stuff is back in the news as of like 24 hours ago or 48 hours ago because of that Miami Herald? Yeah, Miami Herald did a massive investigative report on Epstein because there's some civil lawsuits happening right now. And not to get too far off from that, but... You know, when you
perfectly in line with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you read the transaction of facts around that lawsuit and the Epstein, what he set up in terms of a network and Europe and this kind of, you know, anyhow, Zanora sounds quite like this Venus Villa scenario.
Hmm. It's interesting in Lolita too, where Quilty wants her to get into some sort of sex movie. At the end, and she refuses, and that's how she splits off from him.
I wasn't taken with her character though. She definitely was. It's strange because, she definitely was a pretty actress, but at the same time, the character is so kind of jarring, you know, in terms of.
One of the most admirable things is that how she's completely, she's the most grown up person in the room in a lot of ways. She's completely aware of what's going on.
Yeah,
like she's
yeah,
not exactly. I mean, she is being taken advantage of, but in a way she's, because I think you go back to that scene where, right in the beginning, where he sees her for the first time and she sees him and sees what happens. She's watching him and she's like, knows exactly what's right. going on. And I think her performance is so great because she conveys that so perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very, in that, in all this way, she's kind of a very strong character. And at the end, she's kind of like, yeah, I made it through. And, you know, and Humbert's the one who's fucking pathetic. Like,
yes,
just victim of his own disgusting, I don't know, philosophy. So in that way,
I was just going to say that love is, you know, it's kind of a statement on this kind of childlike, innocent love where it's naive. It doesn't really adhere to like the real world ramifications of kind of what that would implies.
Yeah.
And, you know, if that makes sense. And there's an addiction element too, which is so sad because when I said I related to Humbert as a protagonist, it's that he's suffering. You know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? It's not that, I can relate to his attraction to this woman. That may be part of it. But, I mean, he's clearly suffering where it's this tragedy that the length he's willing to go, the sickness that he kind of basically has, of this addiction. Yeah. He takes his whole life. I mean, and he's getting ill towards the end of the picture. I mean, it's like he's sacrificing his own life for this love. And the point you made, Doug, about she's so uncouth and kind of she's like burping. And I mean, I don't remember exactly what happens, eating Cheetos. And I mean, it's almost like this weird juxtaposition where, you know, her body is like this addiction to her body, but everything else about her is so ill refined in a way.
It's real. It's not an abstraction. She's a human, I guess.
But she's pretty clever too. Like when she's that scene where he's reading poetry to her, and she catches on right away, the structure of the poetry, the symbolism, everything, and she brushes it off. It's like she's already above him on that level as well.
Exactly.
She's interesting. It's kind of this kind of ambiguity of the nympha, right? Like, so you have this young girl who is a victim just because she's so young, but then she has such a power over this older man, you know.
But later she says that Claire Quilty was a genius and that she was his true love or her first love. So yeah. I don't know how clearly I mean, how clearly is she seeing it? If maybe she's seen the game before. I don't know.
Last time you were convincing us that Nabokov does not do symbolism, and so right. These aren't metaphors for anything else.
Okay.
Is that?
Yeah,
would you say that about this too?
Yeah. So this is a strange thing: is that Nabokov hates Freud. Right, he hates Freudian psychology, and people keep saying, "Well, Lolita is Freudian," you know. But he would disagree with it completely. Yeah, yeah, in a way.
Isn't there like literally a Freud character that he talks about?
The
German
Peter Sellers. Yeah, comes in
the Peter Sellers. Yeah,
he's in the book too.
Right.
Sorry, I interrupted.
Well, no, it's interesting. All the people that Peter Sellers kind of plays. Like you have the cop, and you have the psychologist, and who else? The guy on the phone. I'm not sure who that is. Like, who is he impersonating? The guy on the phone.
Forget.
But it's all of these kind of authority figures, right? And he's trying to. He's trying to scare Humbert with his authority. There's that part of it as well. Like he, like in a way, it's from a Freudian point of view, it's this Lolita's lost father figure and trying to who gets to be the daddy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then Quilty himself is like the the New Age, which would have been more of the, you know, so he tried to put her in a porno.
Right.
So it seems strange because it's like the opposite of, you know, so, and I'm not familiar with that actor who played Humbert.
James Mason?
Yeah.
James Mason.
You watch more old movies.
Yeah, I guess so. I love his voice.
He's a classic British.
Yeah.
Effete. Right. You should watch North by Northwest or something.
Well, that's Cary Grant.
But James Mason's in it. Oh, he's the villain.
Yeah, he's the villain, yeah.
He's in like everything.
To go to Hitchcock, I mean, there's your Hitchcock, Doug. And that film has a similar quality because it's kind of a travel movie and there's a chase. And but I just want to go back here because this point about Lolita that we were talking about earlier, it's very interesting because by the end of the movie, she's got a family. She's pregnant.
Yeah.
She cares about her husband, who's a very just kind of a down-to-earth, kind of salt-of-the-earth American type. And so she makes this arc in the film from being like this very this exploited and like savvy and kind of, you know, cutthroat young woman who can deploy her sexuality to kind of using that in a way to defend her family and kind of get out of this lifestyle, this exploitation. And I think that moment where he gives her the cash and starts crying, I do think there's some kind of an acknowledgement with on Humbert's part of just like almost he recognizes his guilt, the insanity of his situation.
Yeah.
He releases her to kind of have an attempt at real life in a way. And then he goes and kills and kills Humbert, you know, kind of knowing that he could never heal his sickness or
Quilty.
Something like this.
He's going to kill Quilty.
Going to kill Quilty. And so Humbert, it's almost I find that a redeeming aspect of his character that he kind of takes Quilty out, takes himself out, but kind of gives her all the money, and maybe hopefully she has. I mean, I think that's I don't psychologically I don't have much hope for her like ultimate healing. That's a lot of hard work to do on her part, but and we don't know that, but at least we release her, you know. And I think that there's a redeeming aspect to that. And by the way, a good friend of mine plays the husband in the remake. A friend of mine from Austin.
Oh,
yeah. He doesn't have any lines. He said that the all the lines were cut. All of his lines were cut. But you see him in the background building the shed in the remake. But yeah, he's a personal friend. I've known him for years.
You know, SJ, so. That's really funny because, you know, I have a friend who, did I tell you guys that I have a friend who was in London at the time of Eyes Wide Shut, and he auditioned for a part as one of the gang of kids that insults Tom Cruise and got the part and then decided not to take it because he didn't want, his visa was running out and he just decided to move back to New York, but he and then he later was like felt so bad that he missed his chance, but that's interesting. SJ, yeah
it's cool. Yeah, and he was disparaging of the movie. He was, you know, mad because his scenes got cut basically. But that character of just, I'm just wondering how it plays into all this because he's kind of above the fray in a way, in the sense that she's even hiding the lifestyle. Like, don't tell my husband. I mean, you know, we can't let him know about our history and, but you know, please help me help us escape and have this child. So I wonder, just like how much she is, what does her life look like after the movie? How much is she kind of reformed? How much is she still scheming? I mean, these are just, you know, exploration
up to be Shelley Duvall or Nicole Kidman or something in the other Kubrick movies, just kind of relating the characters.
The that scene immediately before that, SJ, when he first goes to the door and then she answers the door and she looks like a pregnant housewife, and you could tell exactly at that point like his whole sort of mythology of her collapse all at once, you know. Just an interesting point. Yeah.
He was willing to grab her and go.
Yeah, it seemed like with the money too. Like the money was for them. You know, he was half expecting her to, or more than half expecting her to go with him. and then they would have the money. So he had the money in either case, almost.
Hmm. Hey, David. Is David here?
David's on here.
Hey. How's it going?
Oh, hey.
Hey.
David is here.
Can you hear me? I don't know how I have this set up if it's...
Yeah, you're on. You're on.
Yeah, okay. Loud and clear.
Cool. I don't know. I'm probably going to hang back on this call. I'm not probably going to be too communicative.
That's great. That's fine.
No sweat.
Cool.
So, Dennis and Znor, yeah, I should... Whoa. We got some feedback.
Is that on David's end?
Oh, I think it's yes. Yeah, I was trying to keep the microphone off because I think that I have this computer hooked up to a sound system, so I think it's gonna fuck with it. So hold on. Is it better? Does it sound better?
Yeah, just right
I
now.
I think so.
Cut out the okay, buzz. Cool.
I was gonna say in terms of Ada or Ada,
Arda.
I've been doing a little reading, and I think one thought is, so if we think of the characters in Ada as actually physically in a book, and so the idea of Terra would be, you know, what if, you know, we were trying to say maybe this is inner space or the outer space. Where are these people going to this other world? The other world is you know, reality. So it's like the characters are in the book thinking about what's beyond the book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's just one thought. I want to read a little bit more kind of ancillary stuff about... I mean, so that talk really got me jazzed about that. But this movie seems so... This movie seemed pretty strange as far as, like... I mean, I would have never guessed. It didn't seem super predictable. Like it was kind of bizarre. The mystery of Quilty, and like I didn't know if Peter Sellers was just doing characters. Like the audience doesn't realize this is Peter Sellers doing characters. I didn't realize it was going to come back around, and there was this you know devious. There's a kind of a Crying of Lot 49 quality to that movie a little bit in that the mystery and the weird names and the like the German professor and
Dr. Zimpf.
Zimpf.
Yeah.
How do they explain Quilty's character in the book, or how does Nabokov explain Quilty's character? Like, how do they explain all these characters that he does? He's a playwright and an actor, or
yeah. Well, like I said, it's been a while since I've read it, so I'm shaky on details. But my memory of it is actually just as mysterious in the book as it is in the movie. Hmm. With like, especially like a character like Vivian Darkbloom, who is Quilty's mute male friend who's there but is like a non-entity but seems like she's somehow in control almost. And then that name Vivian Darkbloom, I think it might be an anagram for something. I can't remember what, but...
Vladimir Nabokov.
Yeah, maybe. You're totally right about the mystery, and I think that's part of the whole key of it. And Quilty, like, it's like, and especially with the casting of Peter Sellers and comparing it to Peter Sellers and Dr. Strangelove, it's like Quilty, he's a man who is many men. And in that first scene, like, it's almost schizophrenic, like he's just going in and out of different quotations and things, and he's like this weird split personality.
He's hilarious too.
He's brilliant. And one weird correspondence between Strangelove and Lolita is that the very first time you see Peter Sellers on screen in both movies, he is holding up a white sheet covering him, and then he kind of moves it out of the way, and that's your introduction to him. In both movies, in Strangelove, it's a big piece of paper he's holding up in front of him, and the phone rings, and he turns it, and you see his face. And then in Lolita, he's underneath the white blanket in the house, and he pulls it aside.
It's like a death shroud or something, like he's coming back from the dead.
Maybe.
Doesn't he reference Spartacus with his outfit?
Yeah.
Was that the context in the film?
Yeah, he does, and he names it by name, too.
Yeah.
He says, who are you, Spartacus? Come to free us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
And that, that's cute.
It's amazing that, like you're saying, that Nabokov wrote the screenplay, and then he didn't include the background about Humbert, which would have made him a more sympathetic character.
That was my thought when watching the 97 remake, because it really changes how you initially feel about both Humbert and Quilty. Like, it just really shifts it.
Yeah, just the way, the fact that it starts, the first scene of the movie is Humbert going to kill Quilty, and Quilty is such a, like, you sympathize with him a lot more than you do Humbert. Like, Humbert's terrible right from the beginning, right? And so that kind of shifts your whole view of him all the way through the movie.
See, I really felt, I mean, not that I didn't dislike Humbert necessarily, but the film goes on, I definitely gained sympathy for Humbert. And I think that there's another point that I wanted to make, was that it seems like there's a whole network of adults in this town. I mean, that couple at the, the school dance that comes and says, hey, we're different here, and we want the girls to come to our place. You know, so I make a distinction by the middle of the film and towards the end, I'm seeing, like, the true villainy in the movie as being these kind of sociopathic adults that are clearly playing with children. I mean, who was at the party, right, in that opening scene? That wasn't him alone. I mean, there was a group of kind
probably
of villains.
The same people that are at the party that are the high school dance that they're like clearly like propositioning.
Well, wasn't that the daughter of those one parents, the girl Mona, who she later says basically, you don't know anything about that girl, or what is she says, Lolita says some things about Mona. I don't know.
And it's implied that Mona's been, like, violating her parents, like, she's out with boys.
I
mean, to me, and Humbert seems oblivious to this the whole movie. He has this other flaw, which is kind of, what do they call it, hebephilia? I think there's a name for it, where it's just, like, kind of more of a sincere love for, you know, and so this is where I start saying, well, hey, maybe Humbert isn't the bad guy after, he's sick. And he's clearly just degenerate, but he's not this kind of meticulous, calculated, network of exploitation. He's not a part of that. Yeah. Whereas these other adults are. And so, you know, I don't know. I was interested in the point you were making, Doug, about it sounded like you were describing the film The Matrix, where there's this idea to escape the world of the novel into something more real. And I think, you know, how much of this is in Lolita, where you have this kind of evil, archonic, let's say, influence of these adults that are part of this. It's a dark, dark. I mean, what we're talking about here is so dark. There's a heart of darkness here, you know. But the other thing I was thinking about is that the ping pong, you know, isn't that funny? given what we've, you know, in our culture, how that's emerged as kind of a stand in or a symbol for these kind of dark networks.
Ping pong relates to tennis, and
that's what I thought.
There's
too.
Tennis in like every Kubrick movie. The tennis ball and The Shining and the
Alex. I don't know if you know this, but Zanor pointed out that Nabokov was a tennis teacher for a while.
Yeah,
I don't think I knew that. I have to make a correction, because I said that Nabokov wrote the script, but I just looked it up, and while he did write the script, a version of the script apparently. And I'm quoting here, Nabokov moved out to Hollywood and penned a script for the film. The first draft was extremely long, over 400 pages, to which producer James B. Harris remarked, you couldn't make it, you couldn't lift it, and very little he provided was used in the film itself. So it was actually Kubrick and James B. Harris who wrote the scripts, wrote the script themselves. Okay. But I think they do a great job of adapting it in most respects, but that's not really important.
Did you guys mention so far that Nabokov was the first person to translate Alice in Wonderland into Russian?
No.
No.
Wow.
And I don't know. I was thinking of like Alice in Wonderland relating Lolita in certain respects to certain things. Like there, you know, in the 70s, there was like this X-rated Alice in Wonderland. And it was like the most controversial cover Playboy had ever had, where it was like the little girl in the bedroom with the rabbit. Oh. Did you guys know what I'm talking about? Her name was,
no.
was Christian DeBell. And there's like a musician that goes by Christine, and I watched their music video, which was a recreation of the room from that Playboy. And they just like, I don't know, this is very strange, but I took their album that film was on, and I played it with the 70s Alice in Wonderland porno, and it's off the charts amazing. their character, their whole character as a musician is a play on this, this woman, but yeah, I don't know.
And then Krista Bell from Twin Peaks.
Yeah, I'm always like Follow the White Rabbit with Playboy, and there was the first Playboy centerfold I ever put on my wall. I didn't realize was the woman from Rosemary's Baby who falls to her death on top of the beetle in front of the Dakota, and wow. like. And they refer to her by her like real name in the movie. And then that same year in 1968, when Rosemary's Baby came out, there was the biggest disaster in a Playboy photo shoot where that woman fell off this hammock, which was the centerfold I had on my wall. So like when they were shooting that, she fell off the hammock and broke four ribs. And it was, I don't know, take from that what you will, but it's,
got some strange magic.
I just pulled up this cover.
But Nabokov with Alice in Wonderland.
David, it's interesting that in Ada, they refer to Alice in Wonderland. It's the anti-Terra version of Alice in Wonderland, which is Alice in the Camera Obscura. Apparently, a Camera Obscura is one of Nabokov's earlier books as well.
Yeah.
So.
This cover is clearly like inappropriate. I mean, I just pulled it up, David, the Playboy cover from April 1976, and it's basically a little girl clutching a rabbit doll. And I mean, it's certainly implies almost overtly kind of an underage sexualization.
I like how it says how Adam, one of the headlines on the thing, it says how Adam lost his virginity.
Yeah.
This Garden of Eden thing and the whole Humbert's little letter being Adam naked. Ooh, Adam naked. Mm-hmm. It's a little saucy there. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, that's heavy duty.
I also note the bear.
Well, so that's my question. Okay, so the other... something that's striking to me is that when Shelley Winters wants to be alone with Humbert, she sends Lolita to Camp Climax.
Yes.
And so was Nabokov like doing... like his version of Me Too, so he could see the 60s coalescing and he wanted the purity and innocence of childhood, and so he was kind of I don't know. I mean, it's not like a takedown of the patriarchy, because it feels like that's the position of Humbert, is kind of this traditional patriarchal role. But then it seems like when you think of what Quilty is and what he represents and where the culture was headed, it seems like that kind of is, you know, the exploitative factor that maybe he was decrying potentially. Kubrick or Nabokov. I don't know why everyone was so taken with the story, you know? Why did it become a classic?
There was at that time there was this huge interest in Freudian psychology all the way through the culture too. So I think this just fed into it, like you're talking about Hitchcock, and Hitchcock has a lot of Freud, of course, in his films too.
Well, and the prose, isn't it, I mean, just masterful? I mean, I haven't read it, but apparently it's just the genius prose. And so I know even like when I was in undergrad, all of my friends that were English majors, this was like the first book they read as freshmen. And so, yeah, I find that funny, Doug, too. It's like this became young people in my generation. This was the book we give them, you know, out of the gates to kind of, you know, and I don't know if people have this kind of sophisticated analysis of maybe what the full ramifications of the message is in terms of like a societal explication of this darkness in a way.
Oh, everything goes to shit talking, for him. Everything goes to shit for him. This whole it does not work out well for Hubert.
No.
Or Quilty, I guess.
Or Quilty, yeah.
I mean, I was an English major in college and read this book in college with a professor who was a pretty highfalutin dude. And I mean, I don't think it is something that's standardly read in college, but I don't think that means that people really understand it for what it is. Or, I mean, there's just so many, a variety of so many perspectives one can take on it. I mean, you know, and college doesn't really allow for a lot of things, because I mean I had friends writing, you know, papers, you know, explicating the how Lolita explicates the philosophy of Hegel and etc. and dialectics and that kind of thing, which is all pretty boring to me now. I don't know exactly what my point.
What were you saying before, Alex, about Humbert's aesthetic philosophy and that
right.
Well, so disgusting?
I think that's sort of something. He's kind of an. I don't know if you've ever read Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, where it's like, or the book Either Or, where he talks about like different forms of viewing the world. There's the aesthetic kind of realm, then there's the ethical realm, and then there's like the third one is like the religious realm, and like the world of the aesthete is like kind of everything is kind of beauty, I guess, put at the forefront of things, and romantic beauty and romantic love or eroticism, and it's sort of shown to be kind of a inward spiraling kind of self somewhat narcissistic philosophy. And I'm doing a terrible job of actually saying what it is. It's much more complicated than all that, but that's kind of how I see Humbert as an aesthete. He's smart and he's intelligent and he appreciates art, but he's also sort of superficial and not a good person who's totally just sort of controlled by his impulses and urges, if that makes any sense.
I
just want to say here, we've got the novel came out in 1955, so that's quite close to the production of the film. And before this book was written, it looks like Nabokov only had 3 other novels. And so some of my question is, like, how important was he as a cultural figure? Did this novel explode him onto the scene? I mean, these kind of questions, I think, are interesting as well. Because was this, like, a popular book that swept through the country? Or is this something on the margins that Kubrick finds
swept through the world, I think.
It's true though that the movie seemed to propel him like into the stratosphere after that, right? Like he wasn't as well. Yeah, Kubrick's movie helped Nabokov a lot after. It's true that the early novels, he wrote novels in Russian too, right? Before,
right, for the first several, most of them are. He was a synesthete.
Yeah. We talked about that.
Right. I figured.
Call. That's a niche. I tried to look into that in Lolita to see any aspect of that, but I didn't really pick up on anything.
In Wikipedia here, it says he equated the number five with the color red. That was at a young age. The number five was equated with the color red. I wonder if that has any meaning to anybody. That's interesting.
Yeah. Hey, you guys. I got two Lolita syncs on my film page on thesyncbook.com if you're interested. Actually, it's funny. Lolita Kubrick's is the oldest. So, like, if you're looking at the dates of all the films that are up there, the oldest one that I've ever found that I consider, like, you know, a substantially solid sync is Lolita with Please Please Me with the Beatles. Up until that point, it was Revolver with Bluebird. But in terms of the oldest ones that are up there, that's and then I have Adrian Lynn's Lolita with Pulp, This Is Hardcore.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
Yeah. But just I'd like heads to see up, that. Those are there.
I'd like to see that one.
I'd like to see the Please Please Me one.
Yeah, Please Please Me. The first line of the album is she was just 17.
Right.
Yeah. It's what we were talking about earlier, yeah. Uh-huh,
yeah, started on Sue Lyon's credit.
Nice.
Oh, nice. Misery, the John Lennon song, that seems applicable.
Hey, I think I was muted when I was going to ask this, but Zanor, would you restate what Nabokov had said about his fortune and how it would be reversed after, because he lost a lot of his money, right? And then, you know what I'm talking about?
That was something I think I was saying.
He had a dream.
Oh, Doug. Sorry, Doug.
The prophetic dream. Sorry,
yeah, was that a dream or what?
Well, according to the
prophetic dream.
Yeah, this book I read that Freud, Jung, and Nabokov were all precogs. Yeah, so he had this dream. No, what was it? Yeah, so his uncle dies and leaves him his estate. Well, I don't remember the nature of the dream in the
Wasn't it something where, like, after the book gets
so
picked
you,
up, he was fortune would reverse.
So something. Basically, he was after this uncle died, he was set. You know, so he had this estate. He didn't have to work. Everything was great. And then the Russian Revolution happened, and then he had to flee, and he lost all his money. But his uncle came to him a dream and said, "When these circus performers come to you, you'll have your fortune again." And it was like Harry and Kubrick or something. And so it was close enough to Kubrick that in Russian it made sense.
Wow. That's hilarious.
But so I guess, I mean, so back to what SJ was talking about, it sounds like at the end of 1955, so the first printing was 5,000 copies, and they sold out, but there weren't any substantial reviews. Eventually, at the end of 1955, Graham Greene in the Sunday Times called it one of the best three books of 1955. I wonder what the other two best books were. But then, because of that, it provoked a response from an editor, John Gordon, called it the filthiest book he has ever read, unrestrained pornography, and then...
That's when Kubrick.
Yeah, I had to read the whole thing sideways.
And then, you know, they're banning it, and so that kind of stuff always makes books sell more. But there wasn't. I don't think there was an American edition until. Wait. There was. The first American edition was issued in 1958. So, but it's interesting because Kubrick bought the rights to the book in 1959 and then spent, you know, the movie came out in 1962. So all that stuff was, it's a relatively short period of time. I had no idea they were so tied together.
Does Ada predate Lolita?
No.
No, it's after.
Yeah,
no.
Otto's much...
69.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I just pulled up books. Just to say, novels published in 1955. You have Graham Greene, The Quiet American. You have The Return of the King, Lord of the Rings. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Tennessee Williams. The Talented Mr. Ripley, Patricia Highsmith. And then The Recognitions, William Gaddis.
That's awesome.
That's
I bet that
wasn't
the two. I was, yeah, that is good competition for sure.
I was going to say, you guys were talking about the camp climax thing, and I remember there was an Always Record where that became kind of like a heated debate. And from my recollection, the way I retained it was that we were somebody was arguing whether or not it was that, if that was just Kubrick, or if that was Nabokov in the first place. And I think it was with Mark LeClaire. And then it turned out, yeah, that was actually in the book. Is this like a book club thing? Like, you guys all just read this now and now you're discussing it?
No.
They read it years ago.
No, we haven't read it recently either. Yeah. But so we,
The way this worked out is the book club did Nabokov's Ada partially because Terrence McKenna said his understanding of time came out of that book. And we're
really?
Yeah, and we're also just a little curious because we like hard books, and it was a very hard book. But then at the end of the call, Dennis and Zenora and I all we all realized we'd never read Lolita. This was our is that true, Dennis? Had you read it?
No, I've read it, but you had said you had never seen Lolita.
I'd never even
the movie.
Seen the film, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what started it.
And so it's like, well, we should watch the movie and see if it ties in. And it definitely ties into the book.
The character, the mother, is identical, right? Like in Ada and Lolita, it seems like. I shouldn't say identical, but the same sort of
are you
pathetic
talking
character.
Aqua, yeah. Or Marina? Is that what you
Marina.
Does she survive? Does he kill her off too?
No, she dies, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So
just to quickly here, the novel is called Camp Q in the book, and it's changed to Camp Climax by Kubrick, according to this article I just found. So.
Oh, is that correct? Okay, yeah. It's that conversation was years ago. Thank you.
Yeah. And
but the thing is, he's so involved with the script, right? I'm sorry, I said earlier that I might not get that involved because I'm fucking tired, but
we didn't believe you.
Oh,
yeah,
jump in.
Yeah. No, I'm just like, I'm feeling all spacey. I'm like, I guess I'll answer the call because this was exciting. But anyways, I find it interesting that, like, you know, that he worked so well, like Kubrick and Nabokov, like they produced it together, and there's like this congruency, and he doesn't mind like the, like, you know, it,
well,
it's,
I just read, I just read that actually they didn't. I mean, Nabokov wrote a script, but they didn't use very much of it. They actually, him and James B. Harris kind of wrote the script together.
Right. I guess what I'm trying to say is you don't have a pissed off writer at Kubrick.
Yeah,
like, what did you do with my book?
Right.
And
sure.
Like,
he kind of had.
Fucking Stephen King is like, you're like, okay, I'm like, okay, you got Langoliers. You got Maximum Overdrive directed by him, all these kind of things. And the only one that he talks about that he hates is The Shining. And I'm like, that's the best one. Like, of your, you know, but it's different. He did his own thing with it. And then it's kind of, where is that going to go from there? There's another Kubrick thing where he used somebody's book. And I'm trying to remember the feeling.
Michael Hare, maybe? The film of the jacket guy?
Oh, the... Yeah, that
Dispatches.
Most of his movies were from books.
Isn't that Dispatches? Right. Or that might be the other one, Apocalypse Now.
Oh yeah, no, I don't know. I don't even know where I'm going with this. Anyways, yeah, you guys go ahead.
Sorry.
I just think that I agree that Kubrick. I mean, I think he distills the essence of the book into the film pretty goddamn well, all things considered.
Yeah.
I was going to say Clockwork Orange because that Anthony Burgess felt so tight with Kubrick after that he produced that book called Napoleon Symphony. Have you guys heard of that? So Anthony Burgess wrote a book to be made into a movie by Kubrick, and Kubrick turned it down. And it's called Napoleon Symphony.
David, you might, this is an old always record conversation, but I thought somebody had said that Kubrick got the idea for A Clockwork Orange and then related it to Burgess. That's how I had always heard this story. I could be wrong, but
yeah, in the first place,
yeah, there's some evidence for that, that Kubrick went to Burgess, said, hey, there's this thing, write a novel for me and I'm gonna make a movie. Burgess goes and writes the novel.
The story I heard was that he was hanging out in London flats with ex-Nazi scientists, and they related to him what they were doing about MK Ultra. I know it's crazy, but that's the story I heard. And
this is Burgess hanging out with the...
Kubrick. Kubrick. Oh. And then Kubrick told Burgess about it, and Burgess wrote the book about it. But I know that's kind of crazy.
There was that rumor, of course. I started that rumor.
No, Jason Horsley sent some. It's in a biography of Burgess, and there's a detailed claim that's made that sounds, you know, like a well-researched biography. Jason Horsley sent that, I think, to Dennis and Alex and myself at one point for one of our ARs, I believe. Okay. So we can I can go find that a reference. I'll dig it up and I'll send it out to you guys just to get clear on that. But it sounds pretty above board that the circles Kubrick was operating in the like early to mid 60s when this happened were intelligent circles. And the other part of that claim is that there was the novel Clockwork Orange is a manual for Russian, like Malchik is Russian for man, Moloko is Russian for milk. Yeah. Right. That there's some kind of intelligence angle here that like go write a novel where we can give it to our recruits and kind of maybe get them some basic Russian. And that sounds pretty absurd to me. Russian's a really difficult language. But, you know, so anyhow, there's this whole nexus of like the intelligence world that Kubrick was operating in, and that the Burgess, the novel comes out of that. Kubrick's experiences with that world.
And I think Kubrick moved to London after, well, not London, but to England after making Lolita. So that's kind of, it's assuming Burgess is probably connected to English intelligence.
It took a while, though, between the book and the movie. Like the book was 62 and the movie didn't come out until 71. There's some sort of a deal in the background. It took them a while to get it going.
Yeah.
When did the book come out?
Well, we have 62.
Okay. All right.
I just thinking here with the Russian connection. I mean, you've got Russian with Clockwork Orange. You've got Russian in this book with Nabokov. So it seems like there's something here with to explore with Russia. And I didn't realize St. Petersburg was the capital of Russia until the revolution, but that's where Nabokov was born. So he must be coming from some kind of upper crust, family. If what you're saying true is, Doug, about his estate, and I'm wondering about his biography. Just how important was his family?
His father, though, I seem to remember, was a like a revolutionary, supportive of the revolution. I think his father was killed by far right. I can't remember the story.
Well, and that is one of the fascinating aspects about Ada, is that it takes place in a world where Russia has taken over much of North America, right? Yeah, something like that. Or it's Russian speaking.
Not that Russia took it over. It's just that the Mongols took over Russia, and then all the Russians fled and became immigrants in North America.
Yeah, sorry, I butchered that.
So Wikipedia says the author's grandfather, Dmitry Nabokov, justice minister under Tsar Alexander. So that makes total sense. I mean, they were high up in the Tsarist regime, it sounds like, from at least from that one implication of that picture.
Yeah, but then his father was killed by far-right Russian monarchists. He was murdered in Berlin by far-right Russian monarchists. So it's... So I don't think he would have complete sympathy, for the monarchy either.
I don't see Nabokov as. It seems like he wrote in pretty much obscurity for quite a long time. Till Lolita.
Hard to say how popular he was in Russia. yeah, a bunch of his books, probably half of his books, were written in Russia.
Although it is interesting that, because he's one of the few writers whose native language is not English, but who writes in English and writes in English better than anyone ever, mm-hmm. maybe. And so that it given the milieu of the Cold War and the U.S. versus Russia, it is interesting to have this guy who is sort of both environments in a way. And he clearly loves America and Americana, which he puts in Lolita everywhere. So, I mean, loves America, you know, not like he's a nationalist, but like the ideals mm-hmm. or the environment, the kitsch of everything.
So I've just pulled up the Wikipedia thing. His father was killed, but he wasn't the target of the assassin. He put himself in front of a bullet. And this was in March 1922. That was and the guy that was killed was the leader of the Constitutional Democratic Party in exile. So it looks like these were Whoa. Groups that left once the revolution happened and then went to Berlin. And so anyway, to understand that would take reading, and I mean that Russian Revolution is so complicated, and there's so many subgroups and other groups. But I guess my bigger question is just: is Nabokov coming from how elite is he, and how connected was he? Because to even suggest like networks of power and sexual exploitation at that time, I mean, how much of this is a figment of his imagination? How much of this is knowledge that he has from like running in circles where this kind of thing might have been happening, I guess is kind of where I was going with this. I mean,
wow.